Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Alan Lightman, writer, teacher, and professor of the practice of the humanities at MIT. We're talking about his latest book, Probable Impossibilities, Musings on Beginnings and Endings. Alan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
This is an amazing book. There are certain books that I read that sort of sweep you away, and this is one of them. This is a book about the infinity of the large and the infinity of the small, and about how we humans sort of are in between. There's a great quote, clutching our thin slice of reality. Talk to me about the generation of the book. How did you come? What impelled you to write this book?
I've been interested in infinity for almost an infinite amount of time.
On a human scale.
Yes, on a human scale. But I think that it's fascinating to me that we human beings, which are, you know, 6 feet in size and much, much, much bigger than atoms and much, much, much smaller than stars or galaxies, how it fascinates me how that we're able to explore these realms of reality that are much smaller than us and much larger than us. And not only is our size very far from these things, but our sensory perceptions are very, very limited compared to everything that's out there.
And our time span is incredibly short.
Our time span is incredibly short. So the fact that we're able to study and talk intelligently about things that happened billions of years ago and will happen billions of years in the future is pretty staggering.
It's always been amazing to me, and I interview a lot of theoretical physicists. It's amazing that we've been able to expand our vision as far as we have. It's been one of the most amazing things, and I just wish people read more science so that they could really appreciate this.
Yes, it is. It is amazing. And one of the things that we've learned, in especially with physics in the 20th century, is that our perception of reality is very much incorrect. that at the atomic scale, that reality behaves. Objects like subatomic particles can be in two places at once, and our perception that an object is just in one place at one time, based upon our daily experience, is really not doesn't reflect the way nature really is at the small scale. And the other thing that we have learned in the 20th century is that our perception of time is slightly incorrect. You have to be going at near the speed of light before you notice that clocks moving relative to each other don't tick at the same rate. Time is not absolute as it seems to us from our daily life. So both our understanding of space and our understanding of time, based upon our daily life experience, are false. So that's pretty amazing, because nothing is more fundamental than space and time.
I think that was the great breakthroughs of the 20th century with relativity, and especially with quantum theory.
Yes.
To paraphrase the Firesign Theater, everything you know is wrong. I mean, and to this day, because we don't teach that from the beginning in physics, when people finally butt up against quantum theory, it seems insane.
Yeah, it does. Well, everything we know is approximately right at our scale.
Right, exactly right.
At the speeds that we travel and at the sizes of objects that we explore, our understanding of nature is approximately right. It only becomes very much wrong when we're going at very high speeds or when we're looking at very, very tiny things. It's also, to me, it's a humbling experience to learn that your perception of reality is not right, or to say it another way, that reality is very different than your understanding of it. That's pretty humbling, On the other hand, it's pretty wonderful that we were able to figure this out.
Your book begins talking about a philosopher, Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about why you began the book with him.
Well, because Pascal, who was also a great scientist and mathematician, as well as a philosopher, he appreciated the infinities of the small and the infinities of the large, and appreciated that we really did not have a conception of the infinity of the small and the infinity of the large. So he was one of the first people to appreciate the infinities in both directions and realize that they were, you know, that they were unfathomable to us human beings. Of course, science has progressed a lot since Pascal, and we now know a lot more about those infinities than he did.
It's interesting, and people need to understand this, that on the infinitely large and the infinitely small, we have sort of limits of where we can sort of burrow down to.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is larger than we can see.
Yes.
Why is there a limit there?
Well, we can only see out to a certain distance because the universe is not infinitely old. It began at a finite time in the past, and light travels at a finite speed. It doesn't travel at an infinite speed. And so there's, since the beginning of the universe, which we believe is about 14 billion years ago, light has been able to travel only a certain distance. So we can see only out to that distance. And the universe might exist much beyond that. Space might extend much beyond that. But light hasn't had time to travel from there to here. It's like being in a very large ballroom and with chandeliers coming from the ceiling. Every 10 feet, there's a new chandelier. And you suddenly turn on all the chandeliers. You turn on the light switch, and they all come on. Well, you'll see that the nearest chandelier first, and then a little bit later you'll see the one that's further away than that, and a little bit later you'll see the one that's further away than that. And each moment you'll be able to see a slightly more distant chandelier because at that moment there's been time for light to travel from there to you.
Within this book, you hook up with and you talk with some of the most interesting people in science,
mm-hmm.
people who are dealing with these questions that go beyond what is known, that are they're trying to figure out. For instance, we're talking about how large the universe is.
Mm-hmm.
Does space go on forever, or is it finite? And this is the concept that always amazes me: finite, but without a boundary or edge.
Yeah,
how does that work?
Well, imagine if you were a two-dimensional creature, so let's say that you're a very, very flat creature, and you lived on the surface of a balloon. Well, you could start a journey. Of course, you'd have to wait till the pandemic is over, so it'd be safe to fly. But you could start a journey and travel all the way around the balloon and come back to where you started. You would never reach a boundary. You would never reach an edge, but you were able to come back where you started, so that your universe would be finite.
You also introduced such an incredible group of scientists, and I want to just talk about a few of them because I found each one of them fascinating. Dealing with nothingness, which is another huge topic that you talk about. I know, it sounds funny to say.
Isn't
like
it amazing what physicists spend their time doing?
I know, nothing. It's like a big Seinfeld show.
Yeah.
You talk with Sean Carroll,
mm-hmm.
and his quantum cosmologies. And did I read this right? He works with pencil and paper?
Sean Carroll?
Yeah.
Well, he's a theorist, so that means that he works mainly with pencil and paper and mathematics. He might occasionally use a computer.
But he does this with pencil and paper.
Yes. You mean as opposed to...
Using a computer.
Oh, yeah, I use pencil and paper. It's just sort of metaphoric Berkeley to suggest that he just uses mathematics. I think there's probably still some physicists who literally use pencil and paper. There's a great Canadian physicist named Don Page, the University of Alberta, who uses paper and pen.
Well, you know what? He's another interesting person you brought up in your book, because he's an evangelical Christian.
Yes.
And yet he's one of the leading quantum cosmologists. How does he work those two things together?
Well, he has a view that's very that has been it's a philosophical view that God created the universe, but then did not interfere after creating the universe.
Is he saying that God sort of kicked the Big Bang into happening and then let it alone?
Yes, and so. For Don Page, it's a legitimate field of study, and of course that's his field, to study the universe as it exists and all the way back to T equals zero. But before T equals zero, Page would have said that's where God came in to design the universe and to kick it into motion. And there are a number of religious scientists who have a view that's similar to that. I would have to say that if you believe in an intervening God, which most of the traditional religions do on Earth, Mohammed's splitting of the moon and the parting of the Red Seas and such things as that, then that view is really inconsistent, incompatible with science.
I want to get back to Sean Carroll.
Yeah.
He's fascinated in sort of the early universe, very close to the Big Bang, and he talks about the improbable smoothness of the observable universe, and I want you to talk about that for the audience so that they understand how weird that is.
Yeah, well, it's connected to the direction of time, and physicists associate the direction of time with moving from order to disorder. Let me give an example. Suppose you saw a movie of a glass that was sitting on the edge of a table, and the table vibrated a little bit, and the glass fell off and fell to the floor and shattered into a lot of pieces. Well, that would look normal to you, because we've all seen that happen many times. Suppose that you saw a movie that started with shards of glass on the floor, and all of those shards of glass then moved together, formed a complete glass goblet, and that goblet leaped up onto the table. You would say that movie was being played backwards in time, right?
Yep.
So if you think about what happened in that movie, you went from the forward direction of time was going from order to disorder. You start with a fully formed glass, and then it breaks into a lot of disordered pieces. So that's the sense in which physicists say that the direction of time is determined by going from order to disorder. Now, we know that our universe has a very clear direction of time.
Right. Well, at least as far as that we're perceiving it.
As far as we're perceiving it, it has a very well-defined arrow of time. And that means that our universe must be getting more disordered with time. It means it must have been more orderly in the past. And so the question is, why was our universe created at T equals zero with such a high degree of order that would then give a very strong direction of time? And
Is this what Carroll calls the puzzle of low entropy of the early universe?
Yes, that's what he calls, because entropy is the word that physicists use for order. It's actually a quantitative thing that you can calculate. You can attach a number to the entropy of any system, and low entropy qualitatively just means a system with very high order. For example, a deck of cards where all of the cards are arranged according to suit and number, that would be a system of low entropy. You drop that deck of cards to the floor, and all the cards get mixed up, and that's a state of high entropy.
But when we look at the observable universe as we see it today, it's amazingly smooth. Now, there are, little clumps, here, there, and but overall, the picture of the universe is like it's all just smoothed out perfectly.
It's much smoother than what it could have been.
Yeah.
And it could have been that we would see most of the matter of the universe in the form of big black holes. A black hole has a lot more entropy than if you took all of the mass that's in the black hole and scatter that out through space. When it all comes together to form a black hole, that increases the entropy. So it could be that when we looked out with our telescopes, that we just saw a lot of big black holes out there. Of course, if there were no stars out there, we wouldn't be here to begin with.
Right.
Because we need stars for life. So the fact that we don't see lots and lots and lots of massive black holes out there, it says that our universe has a much lower entropy than it might have, which then gets back to the fact that our universe was created with a relatively low amount of entropy, and we have a very definite forward direction of time. I think it would be very unpleasant if time did not move consistently in one direction.
But if we were in it, would we know it?
We went in.
If you were outside of it, you'd be able to perceive it. But if
I don't think we would know it because if you think about memory, has a direction of time.
Yeah.
And if time were constantly jumping forwards and backwards, if you were getting older than younger, like that, then you wouldn't be able to store memories. And so we wouldn't, any memory you had would just last for a short period of time until time reversed itself.
These are the kinds of conversations I love.
Sci-fi book. I don't know whether anybody's written a sci-fi book like that, but just as we're talking about it, it makes me think that I'd love to write a sci-fi book.
Where that happens?
Yeah. So you've given me a great idea, Mark. Thank you. I'll give you 10% of the royalties.
And the book would either be one page or an infinite number of pages. I wanted to ask you, Alan Guth, which is another major theoretical physicist, works with Carroll, and they have a not-yet-published theory called two-headed time.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's funny when we talk about the Guth-Carroll theory because they've had this theory around for about 5 years, and they still haven't published it.
Oh.
I guess they haven't worked out all the kinks in it. But the idea is that time is if you go back to t equals zero, when the beginning of our universe, and you ask what came before, if anything, and of course something had to come before. The Guth-Carroll theory says that there was a universe before that, but it was collapsing instead of expanding. So if you think of the universe like a slinky.
Right, and it expands, collapses, expands, and collapses.
Right, exactly. And time, the direction of time, always points in the direction of an expanding universe. So that means that if you're sitting at t equals zero and you have a signpost that points in the direction of increasing time, it would point away from you in both directions.
Right, I see it.
It's a pretty wild theory, but all of the theories that we have right now about how our universe began or what happened, what there was before t equals zero, all of those theories are not only untested, but they may never be tested because we can never, we can never go back to see exactly what happened. We may someday have a theory that merges quantum physics and Einstein's relativity, which, and we think that such a merged theory combining those two things would be necessary to understand how our universe came into being. We may someday have a theory that gives us an understanding, but we would never be able to test that theory.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Alan Lightman, writer, teacher, and professor of the practice of the humanities at MIT. And we're talking about his latest book. It's a really fascinating read, Probable Impossibilities, Musings on Beginnings and Endings. Let's talk about nothing. Now, first of all,
it's amazing that physicists have a lot to say about
they
nothing.
Really do. But, yeah. You know, you talk about nothing. You begin with Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
What did Aristotle have to say about nothingness?
Well, I think that, I don't know whether Aristotle talked about nothingness per se, but he said that to understand what a thing is, you have to first understand what it's not. And so,
wow.
And so if you're talking about nothingness, you can say, well, nothing is not something. Of course, that doesn't get you very far. the ancient Greeks actually did have a concept of the void, and they thought that there had to be.
When we talk about nothingness to a philosopher and nothingness to a physicist are two completely different nothings.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. What's the philosophical definition or understanding of nothingness? When I think of philosophy and nothingness, I think of being and nothingness. I think of existentialism.
Yeah.
But I know that nothing to a physicist is a radically different thing because states of matter can come into existence and out of existence in nothing.
Yes. Well, physicists believe that there are energy fields everywhere. That energy fields fill up space, and that out of those energy fields, particles and matter can be produced. So what physicists call the vacuum is when you have just the lowest energy fields. They're not empty. You have particles that are constantly materializing and disappearing out of the vacuum.
You write that the modern vacuum of physicists, though, is not the void of the ancient Greeks.
Yeah.
So the Greeks didn't have a vacuum, did they?
They didn't understand the vacuum as physicists today do, of course, because they didn't know about modern physics. But for the ancient Greeks, the vacuum was really totally empty, and they believed that for an object to move from A to B, that there has to be a space created in B where the object can move into. And so they thought that there had to be empty spaces between objects to allow movement. And that's a very different understanding of emptiness or nothingness than what physicists have today.
I think it'd be great to do an entire hour just talking about nothing.
Nothingness.
But we're going to run out of time, and I have to ask you this, because in the middle of this book, you revealed that you had your own epiphany as a child. You were 9 years old. It was on page 39. And that was an amazing – and I want you to describe that and then talk about how it affected you.
Well, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and I was in my bedroom on the first floor, and I remember there was a train – that went by, because I remember the sound of the train. And I looked out the window, and suddenly I had this feeling that I had merged with nothingness and everything at once, that I was in an outer space, and I had didn't have my body anymore. I didn't have any sense of time. I had merged with something much, much bigger than myself. And I felt that there was no time, that the time had disappeared. There was no past and no future. There was just that present moment.
Were you a precocious child?
I don't know. I mean,
I mean, this is an amazing sort of vision, or again, you know, an epiphany to have.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Did you know it was amazing as a child? Like, when it was over, did you go, holy God, did I just experience?
Yeah, I did. I knew that I'd never experienced anything like that before. And I also understood that my consciousness was something that I shouldn't take for granted.
Wow. Does that explain sort of the rest of your life, the career arc that it took?
It does. It does in a way, because I've always been very philosophically inclined.
I know that. I've read your other books.
And so even when I write about science, I'm interested in the philosophical implications of it. And so for some reason, from a young age, I've been philosophically inclined. Even I wrote poetry as a child, and even when I look back at some of the poems that I wrote, there's one poem that I remember where the last line is something, "Will it matter when I die?" And I wrote that when I was like 8 years old.
Wow.
So I just had this philosophical sensitivity.
We're almost completely out of time, and speaking of which, and obviously we could be talking about this book for months. It's a deceptively small book too.
So all of my books are small.
They're small on the outside, but they're big on the inside. So I'm going to give you I just want you to answer yes or no. No elaboration. Is what we call reality an illusion? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. For finding out more about that, you've got to read this book. My guest tonight has been Alan Lightman, writer, teacher, and professor of the practice of the humanities at MIT. And we've been talking about his latest book. It really is like a TARDIS. It's small on the outside, big in the inside. Probable Impossibilities, Musings on Beginnings and Endings. Alan, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.